reading sensationalists from across the fruity plains.
You're listening to the Andy Pin Show,
the smooth talk of the town.
Cool. I've often thought that if our brains got physically larger the more we exercised them, that instead of going to the gym to pump iron, people would go to the library to pump ideas in order to impress the opposite sex.
Look at the brain on that stud.
Have you ever seen a brain that big?
Look at that guy. He's huge.
I gotta start working out my head.
Wow. I'd like to wake up next to that brain every morning.
So tune in the Andy Finn Show and grow your brain. It's the only one you've got.
Listen to the Andy Finn Show at andyfinn.us. That's andyfinn.us.
We are back on the Andy Finn Show, and I want to talk a little bit more about the Bush administration and the current level of fear in the country. I think we're getting over it, and I think it's why the Republicans are probably in trouble. I don't think we should necessarily take out on the Republican congressional candidates, House and Senate members, the incompetence of Bush and Cheney, but they really have been reluctant to stand up to them. It's kind of an interesting phenomenon. If you go back to the, you know, the way Congress has been in the 60s, 70s, 80s, right until the Republicans took over in the 90s, really, they might have cut a Democratic president some slack compared to a Republican, but there was still oversight. They had the Democrats were in charge of the Senate, for example, when the Republicans took over the House in 94, and they had the Senate in 92, but they held plenty of oversight hearings about all kinds of issues that the Clinton administration was doing. And I don't mean investigations, I mean oversight. Right? Are you doing the right thing with the Department of the Interior? Do we agree with the policies? Are we adequately covering people when it comes to this, that, or the other policy? Are we protecting them in a variety of ways? OSHA regulations, whatever it is. And when the Republicans got in, they stopped the oversight. Now, that comes in part from a theory of government that says we believe in as little government as possible, so why would we try and check and see if the administration is doing as much as they should in terms of enforcing laws and enforcing government regulations? Right, we went through deregulation in the 80s. The Reagan administration got rid of a lot of regulations, saying, I don't see why we need all these. And then, of course, the savings and loan scandal jumped up and bit us and cost us $500 billion. That's in mid-1980 money. And the Republican Congress, through the Bush years, they were doing plenty of oversight during the Clinton years, issued plenty of subpoenas, more than 1,000 subpoenas that the House and Senate committees issued to the Clinton administration, and almost no oversight of Bush-Cheney. Now, you could argue that post-September 11th, there isn't going to be as much oversight because we're going to work together. Congress is going to give the president pretty much a free hand. But when there's been these violations, mum's the word on the Republican side, and that's why the people threw them out. In part, it's Iraq, but I really think it is more than that. That they understand that divided government gives you checks and balances. Meaning if the Democrats control the House or the Senate or both, you end up with divided government. And so they're more likely to keep tabs on what Bush and Cheney are doing than the Republicans were. Because it doesn't matter how you cut it. Let's take the FISA case situation. When it comes to the warrantless surveillance that the Bush administration has done, they are in violation of current U.S. law. Now, their argument is, well, it's kind of twofold. One is that in a time of war, in a time of crisis, the president has powers under the Constitution to keep the country safe. And within the rights of those powers, Bush is free to ignore a statute passed by Congress, like FISA. The problem is that that's the kind of thing that he should do publicly and say, I'm not going to adhere to this law. Congress can find him in contempt. They could pass a new law. They could use it as a trial case, bring a lawsuit. Actually, they have to have the Justice Department bring the lawsuit. And, of course, this Justice Department has not been independent of the administration. But the idea is that ultimately the Supreme Court settles questions like this. When you have, I'm not claiming that Bush should be impeached or anything like that. I think he's broken the law, but the impeachment is a reaction of hatred, like the far right folks had for Clinton when they wanted to impeach him over the perjury in the Monica, because he didn't want Hillary to find out he was having an affair. But I'm not saying Bush should be impeached even for much higher crimes and misdemeanors. I'm saying that this is the kind of thing that needs to play out in the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court needs to decide, does the President of the United States, if Congress passes a law like FISA that says there will be absolutely no surveillance without oversight from the judiciary, without a warrant, if Congress passes a law like that, the Supreme Court should decide that, yes, the president can ignore it, or no, he can't. But what Bush did is he ignored it in secret. And then he wants to say, I had the power all the time. No, you violated the law, and now let's see what that means. But this idea that you then change the law and ignore what he did, we'll never get to the bottom of this issue. And the next president that comes along, what will be a good treat for the Republicans will be if it's Hillary, and she says, as long as the presidency has all this power and the Republicans agree, I think I'll try and do a few things that I've wanted to get done. You will hear the Sean Hannitys, the Rush Limbaughs of the world, the holy BS crowd. If you listen to my show, you know that the holy BS crowd stands for H-O-L-I, Hannity, O'Reilly, Limbaugh, and Ingram, and then the BS is Bortz and Savage. Six of the top 10 right-wing radio talk show hosts in the country with a combined understanding of the world that approaches, let's see, not Thomas Jefferson, probably approaches George Bush's, all that combined approaches George Bush's understanding of the world. That's not really fair to Michael Savage. He's got a PhD, and if you listen to him, he'll tell you how freaking smart he is. Savage is actually quite ignorant, but ignorance just means a lack of knowledge, and he is deficient in so many areas. Just his cognitive abilities are really quite limited for a guy with a PhD. But he does dislike Bush. So as my father used to say, you can't hate him for it. In any case, the right will go nuts about restraining presidential power if Hillary gets in. Mark my words. Let me go back to Paul Krugman and what Krugman said in today's editorial. Quote, in America's darkest hours, Franklin Delano Roosevelt urged the nation not to succumb to, quote, nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror. But that was then. Today, many of the men who hope to be the next president, including all the candidates with a significant chance of receiving the Republican nomination, have made unreasoning, unjustified terror the centerpiece of their campaigns. Well, we were talking about this earlier in the show, and Giuliani's the worst. Back to Krugman. Consider for a moment the implications of the fact that Rudy Giuliani is taking foreign policy advice from Norman Podhorst, who wants us to start bombing Iran, quote, as soon as it is logistically possible. Mr. Podhorst, the editor of Commentary and a founding neoconservative, tells us that Iran is the, quote, main center of the Islamo-fascist ideology against which we have been fighting since 9/11. The Islamo-fascists, he tells us, are well on their way towards creating a world, quote, shaped by their will and tailored to their wishes. Indeed, quote, already some observers are warning that by the end of the 21st century, the whole of Europe will be transformed into a place to which they will give the name Eurabia. Do I have to point out that none of this makes a bit of sense? This is Krugman speaking. For one thing, there isn't actually any such thing as Islamofascism. It's not an ideology. It's a figment of the neocon imagination. Now, I talked about that last week, although I don't think I ever got around to that point. I was making the case that Islamofascism Awareness Week on college campuses was a joke for several reasons, but I never got around to breaking down the term and pointing out that it's not really fascism. Anyway, the term came into vogue only because it was a way for Iraq hawks to gloss over the awkward transition from pursuing Osama bin Laden, who attacked America, to Saddam Hussein, who didn't. And Iran had nothing whatsoever to do with 9/11. In fact, the Iranian regime was quite helpful to the United States when it went after al-Qaeda and the Taliban and its Taliban allies in Afghanistan. You know, that's something that people don't often bring up, but we have gotten cooperation from Iran when it comes to certain things. And if this administration would stop its saber rattling, they might find they get a lot more cooperation from countries. But, you know, you could also make the case, you can never go back and replay history, but Mahmoud Ahmadinejad might never have come to power if Bush hadn't put Iran in the axis of evil. You know, let's not forget our history with Iran. We put up the Shah of Iran, I think we put him back on the throne, but we backed him to the hilt so that we could have listening posts in Iran on the edge of the Soviet empire. And then it all blew up in our faces in 1979 when they'd had enough. And when we let the Shah of Iran into the U.S. when Carter let him in for medical treatment, you know, we saw it as a humanitarian gesture. It made them irate. They took our embassy hostage, basically saying there are no rules. And, you know, we've been at odds with them ever since. Anyway, back to Paul Krugman. Beyond that, the claim that Iran is on the path to global domination is beyond ludicrous. Yes, the Iranian regime is a nasty piece of work in many ways, and it would be a bad thing if it acquired nuclear weapons. But let's have some perspective, please. We're talking about a country with roughly the GDP of Connecticut, and a government whose military budget is roughly the same as Sweden's. Meanwhile, the idea that bombing will bring the Iranian regime to its knees, and bombing is the only option since we've run out of troops, is pure wishful thinking. Last year, Israel tried to cripple Hezbollah with an air campaign and ended up strengthening it instead. There's every reason to believe that an attack on Iran would produce the same result, with the added effects of endangering U.S. forces in Iraq and driving oil prices well into triple digits. Well, truer words, indeed, because what Krugman is saying, I've been saying for some time, we don't seem to understand that if you attack another country by bombing it or putting troops in there, that they rally and get nationalistic. We somehow think, you know, we're fond of saying the United States is the greatest country in the world, and we know what would happen when we're threatened. We rally. We rally around the president, no matter what we think of him. We rallied around Clinton. We rallied around Bush. Because, first and foremost, despite our partisan disagreements, if we're attacked from outside, we circle the wagons and we work together. Somehow we think we're unique. This is the problem with American exceptionalism, this notion that we are different than all other peoples. No. Paul Simon has a great song called The Myth of Fingerprints. And the line goes, he said there's no doubt about it. It was the myth of fingerprints. I have seen them all, and man, they're all the same. And the name of the song is All Around the World, that it's the same all around the world. The myth of fingerprints is not that we aren't individuals, of course we are. It's not that all fingerprints aren't different, they are. But there are more similarities among fingerprints. If you put ten people's fingerprints up on a screen and look at them, there are more similarities among them than differences. Yes, there's uniqueness, but they have a lot in common. And we have a lot in common with other people. And yet we don't seem to get that if we attack another country, they're going to circle the wagons. That's what we do. And so when Bush called Iran part of the axis of evil, they circled the wagons and they elected Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. He kind of came out of nowhere with this nationalistic rhetoric, right? After 9/11, we moved to the right. After we got more militant, after Israel suffered the second intifada, they elected Ariel Sharon. Do you know how unlikely that was, that that would ever have happened? I can tell you how unlikely it is, because in the case of Israel, I would have predicted Ariel Sharon could never be president. That was outside the realm of possibility until the second intifada. And then Israel was, their backs were against the wall, and they rallied with somebody they perceived to be a no-nonsense general and would kick some butt. Why we don't think other countries would react the same way is a bit of a mystery. Anyway, a little bit of a song about the neocons and the people in the Bush administration that we're talking about, the angry people out there who saber rattle. And then we'll be back with the Andy Finn Show on WEBR Radio.
Richard B. Cheney swears that Pat lay in public like so much hot air. Insists he and Bush care, waits for the weapons, still thinks Iraq was a threat to the U.S. homeland. I can't understand all the Bush appointees. Where do they all come from? All the angry people, where do they all belong? Rabbit and Coulter writing the words to a book that reflects a strange fear. Who would come near, look at her whining, blaming opponents and damning up dubious foe? Is it for show, all the right-wing parrots? Where do they all come from? All the angry people, where do they all belong? Ah, look at all the angry people. Ah, look at all the angry people. Ambassador Bolton hates the UN, but now he is a part of it all. He's got some gall, push the divider, renominates rival judges, no change in his tone. And he's not alone, all the angry people, where do they all come from? All the angry people, where do they all belong?
Hi, I'm Andy Finn, and I am begging you to listen to my show at www.andyfinn.us.
The Andy Finn Show, Uncommon Talk Radio.
We are back on The Andy Finn Show, and we're talking about fear-mongering tonight. Fear-mongering. So Paul Krugman was writing about fear-mongering in the New York Times in its op-ed column today, and I left off explaining what he said that reinforces what I say here almost every week, which is that an attack on Iran will be counterproductive for several reasons, but one is that Iran has the ability to hurt our forces in Iraq if they want to pretty severely. They have clients, and they have missiles, and they're right on the border. If they wanted to hurt us, they could be hurting us much more than they are. Now, it is true that our generals are telling us that there's weapons coming across the border and there's people on the border that are mucking around and causing us problems. And the Bush administration now, according to Cy Hirst in the New Yorker a few weeks ago, has changed its focus from the attack on the nuclear weapons sites. The nuclear sites. We don't know if they're weapon sites exactly. They aren't that far along is the thing. They're years away from having nuclear weapons. But Cheney had asked the Pentagon to produce a plan to take out their nuclear sites, which are very deep underground in cement bunkers, et cetera, et cetera. And they've switched now to looking at taking out some of the problem areas, the munitions and the smuggling operations on the border with Iraq, as well as some units of the it's not the Republican Guard, it's the Revolutionary Guard. So taking out large numbers of troops or something like that. So who knows what'll come of that? But as Paul Krugman says, that Mr. Pothurst, in short, is engaging in what my relatives call crazy talk. And yet he's being treated with respect by the front runner for the GOP. This is because he's an advisor to Giuliani. And, of course, Giuliani's rhetoric is way out there. Everybody's got to prove they are tougher than the rest. And it gets even worse because Mitt Romney's out there saying things like America's in a struggle with people who, quote, who aim to, quote, unite the world under a single jihadist caliphate. To do that, they must collapse freedom-loving nations like us. As Bill Maher said on his show when he criticized this kind of talk, that they want to dominate the world, he says, yeah, and I want to be Julia Child's... I want to be Angelina Jolie's child. I want Angelina Jolie to adopt me. The point is, just because you say you want something doesn't mean you get it. These people cannot bring down our civilization or our way of life. Okay? And I've been saying this for the longest time. They can give us a sucker punch once in a while, but they cannot destroy our way of life. And we have to stop talking like they do. We give them far too much respect. Here's how Paul Krugman put it today. Mitt Romney. He doesn't exactly say who these jihadists are, but presumably he's referring to Al-Qaeda, an organization that certainly demonstrated its willingness and ability to kill innocent people, but has no chance of collapsing the United States, let alone taking over the world. And Mike Huckabee, who's also pretty dang conservative and is the darling of the religious right at this point, and may in fact win the Iowa caucuses, he says that if Hillary Clinton is elected, quote, I'm not sure we'll have the courage and the will and the resolve to fight the greatest threat this country's ever faced in Islamofascism. And then Krugman goes on, yep, a bunch of lightly armed terrorists and a fourth-rate military power, which aren't even allies, pose a greater danger than Hitler's panzers or the Soviet nuclear arsenal ever did. All this would be funny if it weren't so serious. In the wake of 9/11, the Bush administration adopted fear-mongering as a political strategy. Instead of treating the attacks as what it was, an atrocity committed by a fundamentally weak, though ruthless, adversary, the administration portrayed America as a nation under threat from every direction. Most Americans have now regained their balance, but the Republican base, which lapped up the administration's rhetoric about the axis of evil and the war on terror, remains infected by the fear the Bushies stirred up, perhaps because fear of terrorists maps so easily into the base's older fears, including fears of dark-skinned people in general. Ooh, there's a low blow. I don't think that was called for, Mr. Krugman. And that base is looking for a candidate who shares this fear. Just to be clear, Al-Qaeda's a real threat, and so is the Iranian nuclear program. But neither of these threats frightens me as much as fear itself. The unreasoning fear that's taken over one of America's two great political parties. Well, I don't think I have to add anything more to what Paul Krugman has said. It is pretty amazing when you tune in a Republican debate and you listen to these guys all trying to outdo themselves. I think I talked about it last week on the show, but when they were asked about Guantanamo Bay and closing it,
one of the things Mitt Romney said was he'd like to double Guantanamo. Now, why you would double it unless you've got the prisoners to put in it, I'm not quite clear how that works. The other thing he said was that, how do you put it? It wasn't him. They were all in the one debate where Britt Hume, that Republican partisan masquerading as a journalist on Fox News, he painted the scenario, you know, the action-adventure television show or movie scenario where the clock is ticking down and we have captured a terrorist, but there's a nuclear explosion about to happen. What would you be willing to do to him? Would you be willing to waterboard? Would you be willing to use extraordinary methods? Would you be willing to, et cetera, et cetera? And this is a scenario right out of 24, the TV show. And so they all start acting like Jack Bauer. In fact, more than one person has referenced Jack Bauer in these debates. Where's Jack Bauer when we need him? Those kinds of comments. As though, A, it's possible to have a situation like this. Do you know how unlikely it is that we'll ever be faced with a situation where we have captured a terrorist and we need him to tell us where he's planted the bomb? No, that's fantasy. That's the movies. That's television. It doesn't work like that in real life. And so to pose that as a question really warps the whole debate. The real question should be, back to where we started this discussion, how would you balance, as president, how would you balance the Constitution and what it says about protecting individual rights and the rights of citizens, and about protecting human dignity and decency? How would you balance that with the current fight we're in? And then get specific. Do you agree that we should be using extraordinary rendition, that is, kidnapping people off the streets of European cities who we suspect to be terrorists, spiriting them away to some secret prison outside the control, outside the U.S., so that we're outside of the control of U.S. courts, intentionally avoiding any kind of oversight, and then doing what the CIA does so well, and let's not tell the American people about it? I mean, that's what we were doing back in the 60s and 70s before we cleaned it all up and said, this is not how we want to operate. The fear has risen after 9/11, and we're back to operating that way. So it's going to be interesting to see, but those are the kinds of questions we ought to be asking our presidential candidates, not these Jack Bauer short fuse questions. What would you do if we only had 60 seconds to get the information out of the terrorist? Would you be willing to torture? And all the Republicans said, yes, I would, all except John McCain. And this is why I'm disheartened that McCain has become such a hawk about this war, and he's still in the surge, and he still doesn't see how misguided it was, because he does not have the judgment to be president, in my view, if he can't see that stirring the pot in the Middle East was a mistake, and that more was lost than gained. I mean, I saw that before we went in, but if you can't see it now, all hope is lost. In any case, otherwise, McCain is right on this issue of torture. And so I think we're going to have a very clear choice next year. And while they'll try and paint Hillary as weak, what I want you to remember is that, to a man, the Republican candidates, and Giuliani leads the pack, are way too scared. They're too scared of our enemy, who is weak and small and can't bring an end to our way of life. And they're too scared of what might happen in the future. I don't think that a campaign like that, that's not positive, that's not upbeat, that's not optimistic, can win. I think that America's done with the fear. But I don't know for sure. We'll have to see. In any case, we'll save that until next week. But next week, we will be back with another edition of the Andy Finn Show. Until then, you can read some of my writings and hear the previous shows and some of my interviews with experts and some of my humor at andyfinn.us. That's A-N-D-Y-F-I-N-N.us. Until then,
Remember, do it. Don't doubt it.